We are still in chapter whatever, directional development. I can't remember the name of the number of the chapter in the book. I'll just go back and find out. Chapter 14 in the book, chapter 3 in the Gita, verse 10. And so I'm just going to read now the Gita verses out to you in the six pages we're studying today. Gita chapter 3, verse 10. Prajapati, God in the aspect of creator, brought mankind into manifestation, and in so doing, gave man the potential for self-offering into a higher than human awareness through yajna. Along with this gift, he enjoined mankind, whatever you desire, seek it by offering energy back to the source of all energy. Let this sacrifice, yajna, be your milch cow of fulfillment. I think that means milk cow. Yajna means tends to mean fire ceremony, but what the word yajna means, anything that you do as a sacrifice, and it's come to mean the ritualistic sacrificial ceremony of the fire, but the word has a deeper meaning than that. Chapter 3, verse 11, Prajapati continued, this is the Lord speaking, with this offering, commune with the devas, the shining angels, that they may commune also with you. Through such mutual communion, you will arrive at the highest good. Now, these verses, Krishna is telling Arjuna what God did and what God said. That's what we have happening here. These are not Krishna's own words, but Krishna is saying to Arjuna, when Prajapati, which is in Sanskrit because it's a language of spirituality, you have many exact words. In English, we have the word God, but God just means whatever whoever is defining it means. Whereas in Sanskrit, they have hundreds and hundreds of words, literally, that could all be translated in English as the single word God. So Prajapati is an aspect of God as the creative force. So when Prajapati speaks, it's the aspect of God that's saying, look, this is how I did it, and this is what I intended. So Prajapati made man with the potential for self-offering. When Prajapati finished his creation, he said to man, this is what you should do. It's allegorical, or it's just an image, but nonetheless, that's how it's said. So in verse 3:12, Prajapati concluded, by communion with the devas, you will receive from them the earthly fulfillments you desire. He who enjoys the gifts of the gods without returning due offering of energy to them is verily a thief. So the gods are going to give you fulfillment, and you have to give back. Then 3:13, spiritually minded people offering up the food they eat to its source in divine energy, the devas, incur no sin. Those, however, who make no such offering, eating only for taste and pleasure, are verily feeding on sin. 3:14, creatures require nourishment from food. Food must be nourished by rain. Rain is sustained in its turn by fire, by heat from the sun, which causes bodies of water to evaporate, and heat is produced by the vibration of Om. 3:15. Know this divine vibratory activity to have been produced by Brahma, the cosmic creative force, yajna or sacrificial self-offering, brings the great cycle of cosmic manifestation back at last to itself. 3:16, whoever resists this great rotating cycle of Brahma creating and us offering the energy back, living in sin and preferring the ego-centered enjoyment of the senses, lives in vain. It's very fun chapters. Before I start talking about what's written here. I was remembering, because I happened to be, let's see, we were in India for several weeks of Swamiji writing this book. He started, I think, the week before we arrived, and he took 8 weeks to write it, I think. And so we were there for a section of it, and so we were there for some of the early chapters, is what I'm trying to say. And I recall the process of Swami writing this book. He had his house there is like three floors. His office is on the top floor. living space is on the bottom floor. We weren't staying in the house, so we were tended to be on the ground floor because that was where the more public rooms were than the what they call the first floor in India, but the second floor in America. And then his office was the only thing on the top floor. And he would write up in his office, and then he would bring the papers down and put them on the table. Sometimes he would write in the middle of the night or early in the morning, so when you came by it the next morning, you would have gone to bed having read everything he wrote, but by the time you got up the next day and got back over there, he would have gotten way ahead of us. Because I wrote this in the book I wrote, but he said, I have to write when Master speaks to me. He said, this is not thinking in the ordinary sense. This is inspiration, and if I don't respond when Master speaks to me, why would he speak to me again? So he was up and down, not sleeping, working in the middle of the night, and he set himself the goal of writing 10 pages a day, which he did steadfastly. In between all this, over the period of time of writing this book, he had 30 guests. I mean, when I say he had 30 guests, 30 people came from Europe and America who were all people to whom he owed a certain amount of attention. It wasn't just devotees coming to the center. It was people he'd more or less invited who were leaders of the other colonies that he had to give real energy to. So he was in a great deal interacting with people. He didn't go out all that much, but he was interacting with people all the time. And he would often talk to us about the problems he was facing in writing. And he started coming to these particular verses, and I remember it, you know, just all this about yajna and food, and then that particular verse where he talked about the rain and the food, and then the rain, and then the sun, and he just, you know, was sort of like, what the heck does that mean? You know, what does that have to do with anything? Why, right in the middle of all of this, are we talking about the crop cycle? It was just, and then as you read in there, he realized that Master was talking about earth, water, and fire, which are the first three chakras, and about how creation comes through those chakras and how the Om vibration moves through the world and the things that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. He had in his memory bank the recollection of Master having explained these verses, but sometimes he'd have to dig deeper before he could find it. It wasn't always on the tip of his tongue. Or if he could remember what Master said, he didn't necessarily immediately know how to make that's sensible to people. It would just be a point that would stand by itself, or he would read what SRF had written in their book and he'd find it just not helpful enough. But I specifically remember this whole section about yajna, him trying to decide what to do with this, because several years ago, on one of our trips to India, after being in India for a while, we had gone to a lot of fire ceremonies and pujas and things like that, and there was sort of this thought, oh, this is fun. Maybe we should do a lot more of this when we come back. And Master's relatives in India say that Master was really into this sort of thing. Now, whether he was or not is sort of a bit of a moot question. When he was with his family and people who were into these sorts of things, did he go along with them? Does that mean that he really favored them? Or does that mean simply that when he was with his family, he followed their customs? So we sort of got interested in the outward forms of many of the things that are being talked about in this chapter. And because India is a bit of a Disneyland for Westerners, in the sense it's kind of like a theme park, and you go over there and you play out a lot of your fantasies about what India must be like, or you play out your own past life memories of having been there, this infatuation with these things came back. And I had the opportunity not long after we returned to say to Swamiji, Swamiji, you know, they have so many rituals and so on. We were thinking perhaps, I know what I asked him. I asked him directly. I said, Master's relatives speak of him being active, you know, being doing all these different rituals. Swami first said, well, you don't know how much he was going along with them or not. But Swami's real response to that whole question was, Master was a yogi. That's how he put it. Like, don't talk like that. Master was a yogi. And now what he meant by that was, and this is how we'll talk this evening, all of these outward rituals are just in order to awaken people to the most fundamental concepts so that they can over time, and usually over many incarnations, understand that those are just symbols for a completely interior way of life. Once you have the interiorization, once you have the true fire ceremony, which is Kriya Yoga, Why would you want to go around gathering mango wood and cow dung and putting it into a fire all the time? It's like it would be such a come down from where you actually are. Now, I don't want to denigrate these things because we recently had the experience of Vanmali Devi being with us, who also meditates, but she has a very sincere practice of puja. So she does a great many of these rituals with more devotion and more genuine spirituality than I've ever encountered in any other circumstance, except for one or two priests here and there. So it can be done as something of genuine spiritual benefit, but Master was a yogi. And so Swamiji felt certainly that the way in which Master would interpret the Bhagavad Gita would have to lead toward what his central message was and not lead to more mere outward things. And so he answers, but at the same time, Master himself said that scripture can be interpreted on all levels. And so the scripture also just speaks of these outward rituals just to get people started. And so it has to happen on all those levels at the same time. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. The basic theme that all of these verses deal with, and this relates, this whole chapter is called Directional Development, and last week was just this long introduction about the direction of development, about people being less evolved who are standing behind us, people being more involved who are standing in front of us, and the whole enormous importance both of reaching out with your energy to help others, give them what you know, what they might not have learned, and the humility and the receptivity to ask and open yourself from those who have gained more than you have yet gained. And so that's sort of the beginning concept that Swamiji was really trying to establish, that this is a process that we have to work with in a certain way, like bringing the tide in. It's not just a sort of straight marching forward. There's a lot of flow with this. And then these Gita verses really just start in with, just right off the bat, I think I'll just read it again, where he says, when God brought mankind into manifestation, he gave man the potential for self-offering. Isn't that an interesting phrase? I meditated on that for a long time. The potential for self-offering into a higher awareness, a higher than human awareness through yajna. Now, what that was saying is that God created us in such a way that we have the opportunity, by a conscious decision of will, to expand our awareness from the little bit that we have at this time. And that's the way we're made. Bear in mind, Swamiji emphasizes that what the Bhagavad Gita teaches is not Hinduism, but Sanatan Dharma. And Sanatan Dharma is not even religion per se. In the book of Revelations of Christ, Swamiji, the first pages are all about what is Sanatan Dharma. He said Sanatan Dharma is not revelation per se. It's what people say about the revelations they have. You understand? It's like Sanatan Dharma is the statements that people make once they perceive reality. And all true masters in the book about Christianity, he's trying to show how Christianity is true because you see it fits in with all the revelations that have ever been made. Instead of saying Christianity is true because there's never been anything like it and never will be again, he takes it from the exact opposite point of view, because this has been the divine truth for all time, and Jesus just stepped right into the middle of that, because when he had his revelations, his own revelations, what he expressed was Sanatana Dharma, which is the eternal truth. Now, the basis for there being such a thing as Sanatana Dharma, which is that anybody who has a revelation of absolute truth will see the same thing, is statements like this: Prajapati, God, made the human being a certain way. And the human being was made with this potential for self-offering. And in that self-offering comes the ability to attune ourselves to higher levels of consciousness. Thus follows the guru-disciple relationship, the need for self-discipline, the need for selfless action, the need for serving others. Just every single thing that follows, follows because that's the way we're made. And anybody who tells you that you can achieve a transcendent experience without that kind of self-offering, we're just not made that way. And the Bhagavad Gita is just one more authority saying Krishna makes the flat statement, when God made us, he made us this way, and this is what it is. Now, it's really important just to really understand that in the simplest way, because self-offering is the opposite of self-aggrandizement, of trying to take for yourself instead you give of the self. Now, if one thinks about every situation in life, whenever unhappiness is created in your own self, it invariably occurs when self-concern outweighs other realities, such as dharma. I'm not just going to say the welfare of others, because sometimes the welfare of others is less important than your welfare. There are times when your well-being also counts for something. It's not always righteous just to sacrifice your life and die. You should not sacrifice your life in a worthless cause. It's primarily when self-concern becomes greater than the commitment to dharma, when you're offering yourself into truth. Do you understand what I mean? I recall when I was 18 years old in one of the very first spiritual concepts that ever really stuck in my mind was, don't think about yourself and you'll be happy. And at that time, I mean, and certainly to a certain extent ever since, but less so, I didn't think about anything else. I mean, I only thought about myself. It was like it never occurred to me not to. What else would you think about? It was like Swami tells the story about one of his little nieces who, she was a small little girl, said to her mommy, "Mommy, what do you think about all day?" She said, "Oh, I think about you and your brothers and sisters, and I think about Daddy, and I think about the things that I need to do," and like that. She said, "Oh, I only think about myself." It's a very honest statement. Isn't that how children are? They just only think about themselves. That's what it is to be immature. The only reality there is me. Children just think that their parents exist for them, and that's it. You know, you try to explain to the child, mommy has other needs. It's a very rare child that has the capacity to offer them their own desires into that truth, into that principle of truth, to willfully give it up. A friend of mine was talking about his little girl taking her on a transatlantic flight. She was only 4. And I was commiserating with him because I've been on lots of transatlantic flight with, especially to India, with Indian mothers taking the babies home to meet the parents, and just the nightmare of that 13-hour flight with small children. So I was commiserating with all that. He said, "Oh, it won't be a problem." He said, "I'll just explain to her what's going on and she'll be fine." I said, "You know, I know people whose children are 40 who would die to ever be able to say that just once, you know. I'll just explain it and they'll be fine." And then I jokingly said, "It must give you the impression that you're a very good father." I said, "Perhaps you are, but you must take into account you have an unusual child. There's hardly anyone at the age of 4. But how often in our own lives, instead of taking the opportunity that God has given us by offering ourselves into the principle of truth, instead we try to take back to ourselves. We want more. Whatever's coming, we want more of it. In the Gita, it also says, oh yes, it was in this first verse, he says, along with this gift is the word that Krishna uses. And it was just that word struck me a great deal. The gift of the potential for self-offering. Now, see, we don't tend to think of it always as a gift, do we? That we have the potential to find happiness by self-sacrifice through yajna. And I was just, again, contemplating this. The gift has been given to us to understand that everything that we desire will come to us through self-offering into the source of everything that we are. That's why reading this verse, I could really appreciate how you just take one verse and you just sit with it for a really, really long time. Because there are just so many little things that when you parse it apart, what you're really looking at is you're looking at the entire spiritual path. The entire spiritual path. Everything on the spiritual path is a technique for helping you to make use of the gift you've been given to, with our own energy and willpower, consciously influence the expansion of our consciousness. instead of just sort of passively. See, animals, they can't influence it because they don't have the conscious gift of self-sacrifice. Animals will sacrifice themselves. It's true. They'll just do it instinctively out of the expansive sense of love, out of an indifference, a non-attachment to their own being. Animals don't have egos, so if they see a duty, they'll often just rush to it, whatever that duty might be. Often, you know, you'll see animals will put themselves in danger to protect their masters because they have the concept that this is what they ought to do. And it's a noble action on their part, but not as noble as it would be if they had enough ego to be attached to that body and overcome it. You see the difference? Last week we were talking about animals, about how they often manifest high qualities, but they don't have the conflicting cross currents of ego. So they're just simple in it. But once those conflicting cross currents come in, and then we have the intuition to understand what we should do, that's the gift that God gave us. Because then it's not passive. It's an active, conscious, continuous decision to do this. And it also says, if you do this, this yajna is what the Gita says, if you perform this yajna by communion with the devas, with this offering, you will commune with the devas, which is the higher levels of consciousness. And also it says, and they make communion with you. Through such mutual communion, you will arrive at the highest good. In other words, we don't receive guidance unless we ourselves put out some effort indicating unless we expand our consciousness. You can't just sit sort of in the commitment to the ego just like it is and demand that God speak to you on a more subtle level. You have to take some action to show that I want to live beyond the ego if you want vibrations that are beyond the ego to come to you. Do you understand? There's a story in the book I wrote about Swami, about a man. I vividly remember him standing there. And he was about to do something extremely foolish for himself spiritually. I can't recall exactly what it was, because he was a person who came and went. I can see his face, but I can't recall his name. He said he was going to do thus and so. He was sort of very arrogantly presenting this plan to Swami, sort of almost daring Swami to object to his plans. And then kind of, in Swami, because there was no invitation, there was no effort to commune with Swami's consciousness, so there was no possibility of Swami communing back with him. Now that I think about it, it's an exact illustration of the opposite of what's being described here. There was no self-offering of his ideas or the direction of his life or his commitment to his own way of doing things or his commitment to the fact that he was right or that his mind was made up. All the different things you can do in relationship to another human being when you genuinely want and respect their input, and you make yourself open to it. You know, that we're talking about sacrifice, and it may not feel like a sacrifice to do that, but in a sense, you see, it is. You're sacrificing the solid commitment to your ego for the sake of being able to commune with something more subtle. And this man came in the guise of saying, oh, I want, you know, you're the spiritual leader here. I want to know what you think about what I'm going to do. But there was no sacrificing of his own point of view into the conversation. It was just a presentation and a demanding that Swami come to him. And Swami's response was there was no connection. So he just listened and hinted, tried to just say something about, tried to encourage him to think about it a little differently. He was totally close to it. And his final ending point was, well, if Master doesn't want me to do it, he can just tell me so, like that. And then he sort of stomped out. After he left, Swami turned to me and said, why should Master speak to him? Same thing, which is, why would Master try to commune with him when he's making no effort to commune with Master? Now, this is what is meant here. We're talking about yajnas, which is the way people think of it, but this is what it's all about. Okay. And then he says, when you commune with these angelic beings, with this higher level of consciousness, now, this is all the directional, all the long introduction Swami was making to explain what angelic beings represent. It's not just that you're going to the gods for this, although that's the way it's discussed. What you're going toward is you're opening yourself to the potential that you, I, as the wave alone, doesn't get our existence just from the wave, but we get our existence from the sea. And so you sort of start moving toward God himself, but in doing so, you open yourself up to every being that's higher than you that's able to instruct you. He said, if you commune with the devas in this way, which is opening yourself, sacrificing your commitment to your ego sufficiently to be on a higher vibration, then you will receive everything you desire. It's really quite a statement, isn't it? Now, it's interpreted to mean that the gods have the power to give you everything. And what leads to, from this is all the prayers for give me a son, give me a good business deal, give me a home, I want this apartment, find me a parking place, you know, I need a job, and a thought to get things. But the fact of the matter is, you can operate divine law for divine manifestation, and the sort of level of development of our society is very much right at that point, which is you can operate divine law for the sake of manifestation. And it's not a false idea, it's just a woefully incomplete idea, because it's not really going to give you everything you desire. But if that's all you desire, as Swamiji said in several places, at least then you get in the habit of looking to the scriptures. That's what he wrote before. That's why they put all that in there. This is what people want, is worldly success. So let them start worshiping what they worship and then get the technique of worship down. And then once they have it, then they'll understand something deeper instead of living only for the ego. Yes?
So the process will actually bring you...
True self-offering in the end will. Because true self-offering, Swami says in the very next paragraph, is Kriya. Because what you're really offering is you're offering the medulla into the spiritual eye. And acting out of the beginning idea that development is directional and that there's a higher level of consciousness than the one I'm on. And so you begin to commune with a higher vibration than the human. And if you deeply commune with it, it teaches you. You see, that's the point. It teaches you. And it begins to say things to you like, well, certainly you can have that car if you want it, dear, but will you really be happy having it? You know, and angelic beings, and then gradually a God-realized master as you progress yourself. But you see, you're standing in that ladder, and if all you can think of now is asking the angels to give you a car, that's the direction you turn. But once they give you a car for 100 lifetimes, and all the other things you desire, and you live a God-oriented life, but not necessarily a profound life, then you yourself begin to ask deeper questions. And you have a habit of communion, and then the answers will begin to come to you, because that vibration will teach you. If you've only been achieving through your own power of your own will and your own ego to work the rules of manifestation without any communion, then you just go in a circle. You never go to self-realization then. You may develop the skills that will serve you well when you eventually become a devotee. But you haven't yet really started on the path to being a devotee until you're willing to look beyond your own ego for to start offering that ego into a higher reality. That's why merely being a good person doesn't do it for you. In the Revelations book, Swami makes that point really clear, and he says it this way. He says, even if you're a loving person and you're serviceable and you're generous and you're very upright and you're very honest, he said that doesn't make you in any way saintly, even though it's common to call such a person saintly, because as long as you're doing it without the awareness of the fact that your ego is just a facade over God's power running through you, you're always aware of yourself doing it. And so it gets you good karma, you know, it's positive, but it doesn't really set you on the path of self-realization, because it hasn't yet occurred to you to define yourself as something other than yourself. You see the difference? That's why Master said, when Swami spoke of a person who was very honorable and hardworking and all these fine qualities, but not at all pious, not at all interested in God, Master responded to Swamiji's surprise by saying, the road to Hades is paved with good intentions. Meaning that even if you're doing all those things, but you're still doing them as an ego, you are earning the good karma that will eventually bring you more, but you're not actually making progress in self-realization. Now, if, however, you are doing those very same things with two other dimensions added. One is, you are not serving people, you are serving God through people. And the second side of it is that which you offer is not yourself, but is your attunement with God, and you're acting as an instrument of that attunement. You can still be like Mother Teresa, who seems to be working all the time for the upliftment of mankind, but she's not serving man. And that was when people would talk to her about what she was doing, about the social benefit and the upliftment. And once a reporter challenged her that, you know, governments could do a lot better job of helping people than you. She responded, she said, I'm not helping people. She said, I'm doing what Jesus wants me to do. Which is I don't think the reporter quite understood. But she wasn't helping people. She was following the will of Jesus within her, you see. There was no Mother Teresa helping people. Like you see many social service people. I saw an ad on television of a man, Christian Children's Fund, and there was this, you know, burly grandfather type. And you could see he was a very good man, and he was the face of some children's organization. He had kids in his arms, and he was trying to persuade you. And, you know, life of enormous self-sacrifice. But you could just see him doing it, not even egoically, but still, it was his good work. And that was the step. He was the kind of person you would call saintly, but you see, incorrectly. But when Mother Teresa was working, she wasn't helping those children. She was doing what Jesus wanted to her, which was also implied that the instant Jesus told her to do something else, she would have walked away from those dying people and never given it a second thought. Because her concern wasn't for the dying people. Her concern was that she be in tune with Jesus. Now that's the self-offering that we're talking about, which is, I'm just living for the sake of what God wants from me. In the book about Swamiji, I tell the whole story of when we tried to incorporate Ananda as a California city. And I worked on that project because I believed in it, because Swamiji asked me to work on it. And we were totally dedicated. I won't tell the whole story here, but if you don't have the book, you should get the book. If you have the book, you can look it up and see the chapter. It was called Sudden Change, I think. Anyway, but he just had the revelation at a certain point that it wasn't right for us to go on anymore. And the whole thing, you know, it was just like I was just absolutely running full speed. And in mid-stride, he said, stop and change directions. Which, you know, once I got my foot on the ground, I didn't have any objection to what he was suggesting. It made perfect sense to me, in fact, once it was received. But then I had the very, very interesting experience of finding out what I was really doing. Because for 18 months I had just, you know, lived and breathed that project. I was always working on it, and then in a matter of a minute it just went away. So, you know, where is my momentum? Where is my attachment? What is it that I'm really doing? Am I determined to make this political change happen, or am I just doing what Swamiji tells me Master wants me to do? And to my credit, I'm quite pleased with myself. It really took very little for me to change. I retained a certain amount of antagonism toward the people I'd been struggling against. And then I got a very high fever for about 5 days, at the end of which it was just gone. You know, whatever negativity was in there just kind of burned through my body, and then it just, and I've never thought twice about it. Not once since then. And even then, even when I was upset about it, the way I put it to Swamiji was, I don't mind losing, it just bothers me that they won. You know, I just didn't want them to win. That was my little, I'd gotten into it to that extent. But otherwise, if this isn't what God wants, who cares? It's a very good practice at all times to ask yourself, what am I doing? Just, Swami puts it this way, every night, he said, just take everything that you've done and just offer it into the divine fire. Just completely let it go. I spoke also in that book about, I worked for Swamiji as his secretary for a number of years. And during that period of time, he paid me. It was my job. And we got very little money of any kind. And as his secretary, all the Ananda fees were waived. So I didn't have any exterior expenses. I lived in a trailer that had cost me the giant sum of $150 to begin with, and it was fully paid off, which was no small thing even for $150. So he paid me $50 a month. So every time at the beginning of the month, he would literally open his wallet, he would pull out, you know, two 20s and a 10, and he would hand it to me, and then I would use that money to buy propane and food for the next 30 days. Sometimes I would make it, sometimes I wouldn't, but I worked for him, in other words, and he paid my salary out of his wallet, so he knew that, and he also knew, because he knew my heart, that I had no interests except to serve him. It was just the greatest fun and a wonderful honor, and there was no question. He knew that. But every single day when I would show up at 4 o'clock, as I had been doing for weeks and I would do for months to come, exactly at the same time, every day with his letters and everything like that, he would always genuinely seem surprised to see me again. And not surprised because he thought I was such a flaco that I wasn't going to show up again, but just surprised in the sense that like it was a free gift from me, always. There was no expectation in his mind. Where is she? You know, she's, except the only time he would ever say, "Where is she?" would be like concern. Well, she's usually here. I wonder, you know, I hope she's all right. Would never be, "Where is she? She's supposed to be here. I pay her to be here at this period of time." Nothing, nothing. And what I wrote, which he confirmed, I said, I felt that every single night he just offered everything back to God, everything, every expectation, no matter how steady and predictable it was, he just offered it all back to God so genuinely that the next morning it was always interesting to see what would return. And when I would return, it was like, "Oh, well, there you are again. Isn't this delightful? You know, I've enjoyed your company. I'm so glad you're back." He would never say any of those things, but that was totally the consciousness that he offered, because his only commitment was to do what God wanted. And he offered every other desire, every other thought, every other accidental attachment. He says that, like, he talks about how shepherds out in the wild will sit by the fire and then pull the burrs off of their blankets or pull the fleas off of their animals. He said, you should do that every night. He said, mentally, build a mental bonfire and take every burr of attachment or expectation that's gathered during the day and throw it into the fire so that when you go to sleep at night, you have a completely clean slate. You enter your subconscious with a completely clean slate. Isn't that a beautiful thought? Because God has given us the potential for self-offering. Now, self-offering is also, I didn't say this because I was, it's such a beautiful concept. Swami sometimes uses the word surrender, and I've heard him use it often. But at other times, he speaks against the word surrender. He said, surrender sounds like something you do only after you're whooped. You know, when they've got you backed up against a corner, and if you had a choice, you wouldn't do it. But there's really nothing else you can do. You can't fight anymore and with any hope of winning, so then you surrender. Of course, there's a whole other definition which can sound more soft and sweet than that. But he said self-offering is something that you don't have to do it. There's no compulsion here, and that's why God gave it to us as a potential. It's the potential if we choose to accept it. And it's a gift, because if we accept it, then we discover that it becomes the root by which all the desires that we're trying to get by holding on to ourselves is, we find that it becomes the milk cow of the fulfillment of all our desires, because our true nature is bliss. Our true nature is to be one with God, but the soul has identified with this little egoic body. And as long as we cling to it, and there's many references in this, in these passages to the concept of source. Now, it's really a very simple idea, and so much in life makes it so clear. You know, you give to the source of what gives to you. If you're a sensitive person at all, as you grow more into maturity, for example, you will begin to appreciate what your parents had to do to raise you. You know, that they were the source of, if you were well-raised, if they were generous, if they were conscientious in it, or even if they simply did their best, you begin to realize how much you owe your parents, and all the principles of honor thy father and thy mother is really just, again, it's just based on trying to get us to tune in to those who give to us. We need to give back to them. And when everything about our lives, the source of our lives, and everything we experience, and the potential for bliss that is our own nature, The source of that is not our own consciousness. It's not ourselves we should be praising and holding on to. We need to give back to the source. And those who don't give back never prosper. I mean, they don't prosper. They may prosper financially, materially, but they never really prosper. I mean, think about it. People who just take and never give back, also, eventually, the well runs dry. People who act without gratitude, God is not inspired to give. I was thinking of it, if somebody gives you if a friend just buys you a pearl necklace, and when you get it, you say, oh, it's pearls. You know, I don't like pearls. I really wanted lapis. There was a lapis necklace where there's pearls was for sale. Why did you get these pearls, you know? Of course, the next time it's your birthday, you're lucky if you get a card. It's like, why would you, if somebody's so ungrateful and so unwilling to give back when gifts are given? And that's how the divine is working with us. God gives us this potential for great happiness. And it's inherent within us. It's the way we were created. And if we respond with generosity and gratitude and self-offering back to that source. But see, how do you self-offer? It's not like, like Ramakrishna teased that man, or how is it? The joke that goes, why wasn't my prayer answered? I put $100 into the offering plate. Well, God already is that $100. What did you expect? Oh, I built you a big church. This devotee came to Ramakrishna and he was saying, well, you know, I'm such a good devotee. I gave all this money here and I built this temple here and I sponsored these pujas over there and I've helped this hospital. And Ramakrishna, in his very childlike manner, just said, oh, I wonder how God got along before you were born. You know, it's like, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Even if you say you're doing it in a spiritual way, if you're doing it without any self-offering, where is that? Speaking of that, I just remembered a joke this morning. We told Rick and Barbara, then I'll take a break. I'll just change the energy with this joke. This was a conversation between a $20 bill, a $10 bill, and a $1 bill. And they were just conversing about, you know, all the experiences they'd had lately. And the $20 bill said, oh, you know, I was in Vegas for a while. And then I got to spend time in Nordstrom's, and I've been to Bloomingdale's several times and a lot of time in Macy's. And the $10 bill said, well, you know, I've been to Target quite a bit. I've been in and out of Walmart. You know, every once in a while I make it all the way to Macy's, but I've spent more time in Walgreens. The dollar bill, they said, well, where have you been? He said, churches, 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 churches. Let's take a break. Okay. Chigini asked the question about fire ceremonies, saying that a fire ceremony is sort of an obvious symbolic event because it's such a perfect reflection of the inner energy. Is that a fair way to say it? But what I realized when you said that is, you see, every time a master comes, every time an avatar comes to create a new expression of Sanatana Dharma, he does it in the context of what the times and his disciples need, and also perhaps what balancing energy is required from whoever was the most influential before, such as Buddha brought Sanatana Dharma in its pure form, but his disciples began to make it... They lost the concept of communing with a higher vibration. They lost the upward direction toward God. They were losing that kind of devotion. They were becoming almost atheistic, which is what they've sort of become now. Buddha came to correct too much of a passive reliance on the gods. So he didn't talk about the role of God in it. He talked more about your own self-effort. So then Buddhists began to say, well, our teaching is about self-effort. It's not about God. And it was actually beginning to undermine the fundamental edifice of Sanatana Dharma in India. So Shankaracharya came, and he pushed the Buddhist teaching back and restored the devotional Sanatana Dharma and set up temples and idols and rituals. You know, he went very far in that form of symbolic devotion, not because he himself was any more, he didn't have any need for it. It wasn't like he was... It was really a higher teaching, but it was necessary to restore that kind of heart devotion. And the symbology of gods and deities, because it was, everything was aberrating away from it into what was really untrue. But what I'm saying is that every spiritual tradition that really has power, that is a lasting tradition, is a revelation through some realized being who then translates that revelation into some external reality, either words or actions, that is true to Sanatana Dharma, true to what they've seen. And so all of these prayers and rituals and fire ceremonies and so on, in their origin point, was some great soul perceived this as, just as you say, as a perfect symbol. For those who can't understand right at the beginning, the action of Kriya, bringing the energy up the spine and offering it into the spiritual eye and dissolving your lower inclinations to seek fulfillment outside of your attunement with God, you know, and how all those karmas can be just burned up in the fire of devotion, and how the light of the spiritual eye will just transmute your entire consciousness. You get a fire, and you offer different things into it that represent different elements, and or you have an image of the deity, and you take all your senses and you offer them symbolically. And so what you're doing is, by that effort to say, this is who I am, and I offer it in service to God, and I give it to God, instead of just going about my business without ever thinking about where these gifts come from or how they're used, I will stop every day, every morning, in this particularly ritualized way, and I will say these certain prayers, which are perfect articulations of what it is I want to affirm for myself, and I will stop the outward-looking energy of my senses and focus in on this ritualistic form and do this again and again. We have our own ritual in the Festival of Light. When I asked Swami that question about pujas and ceremonies, he also said, I think the Festival of Light is enough. And he said, we have a little arati there, we have a little blessing. I think that's enough, he said. He did fire ceremonies. He didn't do any aratis or any pujas. Swamiji said, in answer to that same conversation, he said, Master knew all those things. He never taught them. But he occasionally did mantras, and he did some fire ceremonies. I'm not quite sure how much, but the fact that when Swami started Ananda, he was on his own for the first time, he did the fire ceremony exactly like the one we do. And that was what he brought there. He would only have brought that if that was what Master did. He would never have started that. I never asked him the question directly, but there's a few pictures you see of Master with a fire. And and just occasional ceremonies, you see him with a fire. Swami would never have done that if Master hadn't done it. So I know for a fact that that's true, so I can only say that he must have known that was what Master would have approved of in one way or another. So it's the Gayatri Mantra and the Om Triambakam mantra, the Maha Mrityunjaya mantra. Anyway, but that's enough. And then Swami put in the arati with the candle for the Festival of Light. I don't know of any instance when Master actually did an arati like that, but Swami felt inspired and he thought that was enough. It was kind of a little bit of a tiny bit of this and that, because it's such a beautiful symbol to take the light with in you and hold it up to the masters. Because Carol asked the question, what is self-offering? Well, self-offering is, instead of using our energy, our thoughts, our actions, our whatever, just to come back in self-aggrandizement, it's to take our energy and offer it first in divine service, or offer it first with just the complete awareness. I mean, think like this. Let me think of how I could say this. Just the constant inner prayer, which is, Lord, I'm doing this for you. I'm not doing this for myself. You know, we're doing this together. You're a school teacher. I'm helping these children because I felt inspired by you to help these children. Help me to help these children. You know, I'm in total despair about my mother being sick, but I offer that sadness to you, Lord. I'm not going to just cling it to myself. You've sent it to me. It's from you. I offer it back to you. This is what you've given to me. I accept it in your name, but I'm not going to I'm not going to think of it as separate from you. It's making sure that everything that happens to you and everything that you are, you recognize is from God and belongs to God. It's not separate from God. I was trying to solve some problem and I just couldn't solve it. And I finally just said, Divine Mother, you know, if you want this to work out, then you can make it work out. And if not, you know, so what? And it was just like I just offered all my anxiety and all my thought of having to run in circles and deal with it. It's just, well, Divine Mother, it's your problem. You know, it's just the self-offering of, and see, the ego wants to just keep being involved and hold on to it and make it happen in its own way. And instead, you just offer that in. I remember once a man was trying to make a difficult decision. His mind was running in all directions. And I said, you know, all that energy you're using in anxiety, you need to use all that energy to hold your consciousness perfectly still. And just offer the whole situation to Divine Mother. But I'm saying it's not passive. Because as much energy as you're using to be anxious and run in circles, you have to use all that energy to be perfectly calm and still. In the fire of your inner awareness, you offer in all your emotions and all your anxieties and all your fears about how it's going to be. You make the offering of all those qualities into God's hands. You give them to God, you know? And here's my talent, and I feel that I'm supposed to be a singer, but there's no opportunities for me to sing. Well, I offer that desire to you, and I, you know, I will pursue it. It's not that you become passive, but I've offered it to you. So from now on, I'm going to do it as you guide me to do it. I'm not just going to do it the way I think it ought to be done. You know, 90% of the spiritual path is just remembering that you're not alone. Just really as simple as that. Years and years ago, I was working for Swamiji, recording an album for him. This was when he moved to San Francisco in 1979, I think it was. And he bought a tape recorder, you know, those old tape recorders like that. And he wanted to make some chanting tapes. And, you know, I have no capacity that way, but I actually became his recording engineer, which is a really bizarre thing, which primarily consisted of turning the machine on and off and making sure the tape was running. And he was teaching a lot of classes in San Francisco, and then after everything was over, we'd go back to his apartment, and he would record the album, which is called Music for Meditation. I'm not quite sure if it's still out or not. It's just a solo album of Swami chanting with the harmonium from 1979. And one night, it was really late, and I do not know what was wrong, but I couldn't make anything that went into the microphone come onto the tape. And I mean, I know zilch from zilch, so if it didn't just work, I didn't know what to do. I read the instruction books. I tried to call a couple of people. Nobody could help me. He meditated for a while. He came back out. You know, can we do some recording? I can't make it work yet, sir. Okay, I'll go meditate some more. But it was like midnight at this point. Finally, I just was sitting there, and I didn't know what to do. And I said, Divine Mother, if you want this to work, you're just going to have to do something because I'm at the end here. So I just took the problem. I offered the problem to her. I offered my desire to serve Swami to her. I offered my humiliation at not being able to solve this problem to her. I just put the whole thing in her lap. I unplugged every single wire. I unplugged all of them, and I plugged them all back in, and the thing worked. I mean, I had checked those connections. It wasn't like that had just occurred to me. But I just offered it to her, so I started over from scratch. Now this is your project. I plugged it all back in, and it worked. The next night, Swami was teaching, and somewhere in the class, he just stopped the class, and he said, Asha had an, because then he comes out and said, what did you do? I said, nothing, sir. I prayed. And then I just unplugged and replugged, and now it's working. I said, of course. And that the next night, in this big class, he points to me and says, Asha has something to tell us. So I said, sure. You know, I walked up, and I said, what? You know, I didn't know what I had to tell them. He said, you know, with the recording last night. Oh, I said. So I sort of explained that, and then I ended it by saying, you know, everything he's telling you really works, but it won't work at all unless you remember to use it. And that's really, that's much harder than anything, because we're so accustomed to holding on to ourselves. We're not accustomed to offering our lives and our energy into God. We're just accustomed to doing it ourselves. How many minutes and hours pass in the course of a day without any conscious awareness of being a disciple, being master's instrument, working with God's energy? And you don't have to answer. We all know the answer. You know, how much do we just take the energy and just use it? without ever remembering. I wouldn't even be alive if it wasn't for God's energy just breathing through me. That's the self-offering. Just, oh, we're here together. We're just doing this together. Just think of it like that. I mean, some people talk in the choir, like some people in the choir consciously sing together, and some people just sing by themselves. And those who sing more seriously talk to me about how nice it is to sing with people who sing with you instead of just individuals singing alone. And that's what Karen's always trying to get us to do. Listen to each other. Sing together. Give your voice to the choir instead of just using it. You may be singing exactly the same notes, but the whole effect is different. Now, is that helpful? The other question Edwin asked is a twofold question. I'll answer the easier one first, maybe. When I said every night you should give everything to Master, he asked the question, you know, be more specific. What does that really mean? You know, we've had the experience in our community, because we've been a community long enough, that a lot of people have died suddenly. Not a lot of people, but some people have died suddenly. Lila Hogendyke's husband, David, just a beautiful, saintly soul. He was living in Assisi, where she was living at that time. He just went out for a run. He was, I don't know, 50, must maybe older than that, but not that old, and a real athlete. He went out for a run. He was running with a companion. He turned to his companion. He said, you know, I don't feel very well. And he went like that, and he sat down on the curb. He died. Just like that. Not a bit of warning, anything. I don't feel very well. He sat down, his heart stopped, and he was gone. Just like that. Diana Bluer's husband, Phil, he was an older man, and he'd had some serious health problems, but he seemed to be well. They were in their house in the evening. He got up from the bedroom. He walked into the bathroom. He stepped into the bathroom. His heart stopped, and he died. I think of it like that. I think of you're in the bedroom here, and you step what you think is into the bathroom, but you actually step into the astral world. You know, it's just like one step like that, and you're actually stepping out of your body. You don't realize you're doing that. Now, most of us, it's not really that I expect us to die at this moment, but honestly, you never know, and it's not really such a big deal from my point of view. You know, you could just go out and get hit by a bus and just, that's the end of the story. You just, no one knows how long. Phil didn't know his life was just about to end. David Hogendyke certainly gave no hint that he knew his life was over. So what that has done for me, it's really inspired me with a very simple thought. You really want to be current. You just don't know, you know, whether that's going to be your final exhalation. And you don't want to have a lot of old, unfinished business going on at that point. Think about how many things that we know we need to face and resolve, but we're just like not ready. We're just hoping that we can get away with it. We're just like drifting along and not really putting energy into it. And David and I have been assigned to this colony for 20 years now. Twice, seriously, we were almost transferred. Once for 24 hours we were going to be transferred, and once for a little longer. There was one real serious where we actually had a new assignment for 24 hours and then it was rescinded. And another time Swami talked seriously about sending us to the East Coast. And then a third time we thought he was trying to send us to the East Coast and he thought we were trying to get transferred to the East Coast. So we had a misunderstanding, but led to the thought that we were about to leave this area. After that, he more or less said to us, and you may consider this good or bad news, essentially, I hope you like it in Palo Alto, he said, because it's like he couldn't really see that there was going to be some big radical shift in the near future or perhaps ever. That's how I heard it, at least. I heard it to pick out the place where you want your ashes scattered and just relax. Regardless of whether that's actually what he meant or not, I took it that way because what was so interesting to me was when I actually just faced into the thought. Now, you know, many of you have just only seen Ananda in this very stable period. Ananda had a dream once in which there was a meeting of all the leaders of Ananda colonies, and Someone wanted him to speak about being in an Ananda colony because, after all, he'd been living in Sacramento for 50 years, which was just like he was in the dream. You know, he was like 50 years. And then he looked over and he saw me, and I was this wizened old woman, you know. And I'd been in Palo Alto for 50 years, and he'd been in Sacramento for 50 years. And it was just like this, oh, my God. Because there was a period of time, which was the first 16, almost 20 years of our lives at Ananda. Once I had 7 jobs in 14 months. So there was no thing like you'd go somewhere and stay there. It was just always, you were always being moved around. And it was just sort of like that. We were always being moved around. You were always changing, always doing something else. And Swami himself said, one of the things he said is, well, some of you someday are going to be running your own communities, and you're going to need to know all aspects of it, which was a very far-fetched idea at the time. But still, it was just this chaos. So even though I've been here for 20 years, the thought form for a long time was still that this was an assignment and then there'd be another one. I personally thought I'd found more than one community. It didn't turn out that way. Hasn't turned out that way. But what the end point of all of this is, and that's all background to the fact that when he really communicated to me that I should not think about going anywhere else and starting over somewhere else, I was amazed how many things I was just putting under the carpet with the thought that I'd get to walk away from them. It was just, I was stunned. And it was all like on a deeper than conscious level. The way I began to explain it to myself is I was just waiting to be rescued. You know, there was no commitment, I was just waiting to be rescued. Rescued from the necessity to have to face this reality. Whether it was like, literally, like a corner of the garden where it just was always messy and nothing would ever grow, or some person who just, I could never really figure out how to relate to them, but someday I was hoping I'd just drive away and never have to relate to them, you know, just, or whatever it might be, just all these different things. And then the thought that I wasn't ever going to be rescued, that in fact I was going to have to stare at those things and deal with them because nothing would ever spare me from dealing with them. It just made me realize how often, Swami uses that in one of our Sunday readings. He uses the phrase waiting to be rescued, which is just a magnificent phrase, waiting to be rescued. So coming to your question about, you know, every night offering it to Master, it's like we hold all these little things and then we get caught out. You know, we never get rescued, or we step into the astral world inadvertently and it's all unfinished business, or someone else steps into the astral world and we never worked it out. And so the concept of staying as current as you can possibly stay, and of course we have, you know, enormous amounts of subconscious energy, but at least just express the intention, if you can't do it in fact, because none of us could do it in fact, but express the intention on a regular basis, Swami's suggestion is every night before you go to sleep, of just saying, Lord, everything that's happened today, you know, if I was upset with this person, or I'm carrying this little bit of anxiety over that, or, you know, I'm anxious about this, I want to just gather up that whole day and say, Lord, you know, it's yours. I don't want to hold it. I don't want to wake up in the morning with these same realities. Just like I was saying, Swami, at the very beginning, like every night he just surrenders everything. Why have expectations? I had the funnest experience on last weekend. On Saturday, I actually drove all the way up to the village and all the way back on Saturday for a gathering for all the people who were having birthdays at the same time as I. It was just too tempting, and so I went up there for that. And, you know, it was a long trip up and a long trip back. But I realized when I was driving that the only thing that made me even slightly anxious was if I allowed myself to focus on linear time. Because then it was, oh, it's going to take me so many hours to do this and then so many hours to do that. And at the end of all that linear time, I'll have done all this for so long and then I'll feel like this. But if I broke the concept of linear time and was just at wherever I was in the moment that I was there, I didn't have all this accumulated energy that made me feel tired. Do you know? It was just a whole series of things happening and you're always in the now. So what difference does it make? So I realized that this offering to Master, and it's best to offer it to the Guru or to Divine Mother, whatever image really works for you, but have it be that you give it somewhere where you really feel like it will be taken care of. Open your heart to me and I will enter and take charge of your life. My father told me this wonderful joke. There was this place in the town where he lived, which was a retirement community for Christian missionaries. It was a very charming community, and it was a community of little houses, like a small neighborhood. And once a year, they called it Pilgrim's Place. And once a year in Pilgrim's Place, they would have a festival, the Pilgrim's Place Festival, and all the people would come out on the sidewalk, and often they had many interesting displays and things to talk about because they'd been all over the world and done very unusual things. So, and sometimes they would sell things, I'm not really sure, but it was Southern California, which is a very dry area. But on this one particular Pilgrims Festival day, it was raining. And that, of course, made it very difficult. Everybody's covered with plastic. All the displays are covered with plastic. But my father loyally goes to the, and he's talking to one of the missionaries, and he said to this missionary guy, "After all you've done for God, you would think he could give you good weather." You know, jokingly. But that's what he said. And the missionary, without missing a beat, he said, "Weather is determined by management. I've always been in direct sales." It was such a sweet response. But you see, it was just a lifetime of certain aspects of life are not my responsibility. I've offered myself. I'm living, Lord, for you, just doing what you asked me to do. And these are the little problems I'm having, and this part isn't working, and you know, I'm a little concerned about this, but I offer it all to you because really you're the one who's running the show, just like if you had a job to do, but it was just a little beyond you. And let's imagine you have a really good manager and you go to your manager and you say, you know, I just can't get the plant to give me the goods I need. And I have these salesmen waiting, but I can't get them to do it. Don't worry about it. He says, I'll take care of it. And you know that he will. So you don't worry about it anymore because now you just have to wait and he'll take care of it. So you just sit down every night and you speak to the one who's really in charge. You speak to the man in charge or the woman in charge, whatever, however you want to say it. And you just genuinely offer it. Now you can see, let's using that analogy of a job, this question, what is self-offering? You're working. You can't make it to happen, but you don't tell anyone. You just hold it to yourself and you're just going, you know, you're afraid to show anybody that you're not able to do it and you don't really believe anybody can help you anyway and you're just going to do it yourself and you're just going to, you know, becomes impossible. And there's your manager just trying to help you. Sometimes he has to fire you because you just won't let him help you. You know? So God fires us, makes all kinds of things happen because we won't let him help us until we become desperate enough. So you preclude a lot of that suffering by getting out there ahead of it. That's what you do every night. And it also builds a relationship. And let's see, I think I'll talk a little about this before we end because Edwin also asked the question. He said, I've been talking so much about attunement. He wanted me to say more what it means. I told him I've been talking about it a lot because after about 40 years on the path, I'm just beginning to understand what it might mean. And if I haven't been able to say it clearly, it's because I'm just beginning to understand what it might mean. It's a way of moving through the world with the awareness that something is moving you and that you're not always moving yourself. It's the realization that you're not alone. It's the realization that there is and vibration is the only word you can think of, that there's a vibration that if you can align yourself with that vibration, and you see how very inward that is, if you align yourself with that vibration, everything you do will be melodic and beautiful. It will feel melodically beautiful to you. If you're just moving through without listening, without the awareness even that that vibration is there, then you often feel that you're just in dissonance and you don't even know why. It's just inside yourself you're in dissonance. Swamiji said, someone said, how can I know if I'm in tune? He said, by the presence of joy. It's a very simple answer. He said, if you're in tune, you feel joyful. I mean, it doesn't mean you're always smiling, but it's on a deeper level. You just have this sense that when we were going through all those terrible lawsuits, there were some really, really hard and heavy days in there. But underneath it, there was this feeling of we were doing the right thing, we were doing it honorably, we were doing it in the right way, we were in tune with Master in what we were doing. So even though it was just god-awful miserable days, there was still underneath it this wonderful feeling of joy because we were in tune with what was trying to happen and we were doing it in the right way. And if you act with that awareness, and the way you act with that awareness is, first of all, by all the things we're talking about. And of course, I haven't said just because I haven't gotten to it, but he says it in the lessons, you know, Om is the real source. And so the more literally you practice the Om technique, the more you're conscious of yourself as vibration, the more you're aware that your vibration can be harmonized with the higher dimension of vibration. This is where it gets more subtle than just the angels and the devas, that you offer yourself into the Om vibration, and you literally offer yourself into the Om vibration by listening to the Om with devotion, and you're offering yourself into it, and then it spreads out, and you realize that you are that Om vibration. Well, attunement with the Guru is the same reality, which is that vibration is constantly being projected. Swamiji wrote in one of his books, and when he wrote it, he just said it so simply. He said, I project ideas, and those, instead of telling people what to do, he said, I project ideas, and those who want to be in tune with me receive those ideas, and they gradually, they become our ideas, not mine, not theirs, but our ideas. So it's like whenever you're going to do anything, you make that prayer, and especially when you're doing anything of any consequence, you ask, you know, Master, how would you want this done? What should I do next? How should this work? Because the masters are always projecting ideas about the smallest things. I mean, in the business you're in, you know, you deal with a lot of people and their needs, and, you know, God is watching out for you and all those people. So you can just kind of say, well, this is how it's done, and this is what we do. Or in every moment you can say, Divine Mother, what should I do next? And make your vibration in tune with that higher vibration. Master, what should I do? And then the more you get used to that, just like singing, if you move out from the note, you just hear it. It feels really dissonant. Let me think what was... I had an experience of... This was also lawsuit related, but... Some negative things had been said. And because it was toward the end of the whole project, I just decided it was just not worth the trouble to write a repudiating letter. That was the moment. I began to feel very out of tune. Just no matter what I did, there was just this slight sense that I was off. And it went on for quite some time. And a number of people, we all just felt a little off. And then finally it occurred to me that Swami, whenever negative energy would come, Swami would always put out positive in return. And I had left this negative force unanswered. And I wrote this very strong letter. The specifics were not even that important, but I wrote a very strong letter sort of repudiating for the last time this certain kind of negative force. As soon as I wrote it, I felt fine again. It was like the thought was there pushing me to do it, and I didn't want to do it. And so until I really said, okay, what is needed? Being in tune is just making decisions according to what the masters want. I use a very small example, which is not that relevant to everyone, but it's interesting how small these things can be. I always try to buy clothes that I know Swami would like to look at. Not always, but you know, like a dress in colors that I know he would like. I have this little moral dilemma because I bought this skirt, you know, recently, and it's like, I don't know if he would really like that or not. And it just stays in my mind. He might not like this. And it's, I mean, how often do I see him, for heaven's sakes? But it's like being in whatever vibration is his vibration. Now, that's a unique and somewhat too personal example, but what I'm trying to say is nothing is too small. You know, always looking... always taking the trouble to be neat and attractive and taking care about your person and presenting yourself as Master's representative in all circumstances. My husband is magnificent at that. He always looks very nice. He almost never goes anywhere without being very nicely put together. And he's not vain. And when I sort of joke a little, he basically said, I'm always representing Master. You know, so it's just like you get up and you go out looking like a bum, or you say, I'm representing Master. Just a little thought like that. Oh, Swami would like this color. I'll wear this because, you know, he would like it. And so then I'm doing something that's in tune with his reality. And sometimes, you know, it's not important. I really don't want to trivialize this because it's not trivial. I mean, I don't want to reduce it to a matter of what shirt you wear, but because it may or may not be an issue. In fact, Swami took a hand at a certain point in my life in getting me to dress with more self-respect. So the fact that I put out energy to dress with a level of self-respect is when I don't do that, I feel a little out of tune because I it's specific to me. I realize that's the caveat on that. For some people, he never mentions it. What difference does it make? It's not the issue. But nothing is too small. And big things are obvious. Does that help? Okay. And see, what that's about is that when you constantly just try to be on the wavelength of the Master, everything else follows from that. Because our substance is vibration. We are the Om. That was the rest of the chapter that I didn't really talk about that much. But our source is Om. Om is vibration. Everything you do that puts you on the vibration of Om puts you in tune with the Master's flow. Everything you do that moves you out of the vibration of Om, which is selfishness, self-aggrandizement, taking without giving back, self-indulgence, lack of self-respect, laziness, all of those things, they put you out of tune with the upward moving Om vibration. But if you stay in tune with the Om vibration, you don't have to do anything else because your very self then just begins to resonate. That's why Master said, if you stay in tune, you'll never fall off the path. And even if you don't meditate, if you stay in tune, you'll be safe. But of course, meditation is one of the ways you stay in tune. But he spoke of certain disciples who hardly ever meditated, but they got there through attunement, which is they constantly harmonized their vibration with his vibration, which is really just the Om. And through attunement, everything else falls away. And does that make sense? It's just fun and phenomenally important, more than anything else. Because you can meditate to beat the band and, you know, fast and just be real definite about this and be exact about this. But if you're not in tune, none of that's going to take you anywhere. Because if you're doing it with a vibration that's not communing with and, you know, upwardly communing and allowing yourself to be communed with and paying attention to the vibration of things, you can end up at the end of your life nowhere. Whereas if you're just going to be a complete sort of dud in all the ways that people think, but by constant loving self-offering, you're always in the Master's vibration, what else is there? That's why it's so important. Okay? Well, that'll do it. Thank you all. God bless you.